Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like? This is the Overton window at work. The idea coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at how ideas move from being unthinkable to plausible to policy and talk to the people who change what is possible in politics. Now, my dear listener, I will never tire of telling stories about state policy victories, and we have a big one in South Carolina. State lawmakers there voted to lower the state's income tax rates and maybe set up for future income tax elimination. Maybe. I'm here with Dr. Oren Smith, a senior fellow with the South Carolina think tank Palmetto Promise. Oren, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
What did South Carolina do with its tax rates?
Well, let's say the saga is long. South Carolina had struggled for many years with a couple of problems that came together that affected the state negatively. Our individual income tax was the highest in the South and one of the highest in the country at 7%. But to make it more complicated, we were using a different basis for calculation of taxes than most of the rest of the country. So honestly, our effective rate was about the same as our neighbors in North Carolina and South Carolina. But our governor was frustrated. Every time he tried to work an economic development deal, he would hear from the potential employer about what he referred to as the big old seven. And the big old seven was the tax foundation map with South Carolina with a big 7%, which just loomed over everything else. And he could not get past that in his conversation. So We at Palmetto Promise Institute began pounding away not only at the individual problem, the individual income tax problem, but just lots of issues with our tax code where we have constitutional issues, things that should never have been in the Constitution in the first place, just piecemeal changes to the tax structure over time. But we knew if we had to pick the worst thing about the tax code, it was that big old seven. So we began to push through our research and really some pretty heavy duty research. We hired an economist to do the research for us to show what could happen if we made some changes to our tax code. So finally in 2025, after the 2024 general election, we were able to get a bill up before the General Assembly and to start that debate, and that bill was actually signed into law.
So why the income tax and not the other taxes?
Well, I think the 2024 election was key to that. We are one of the states that elects its entire Senate every 4 years, but the House only 2 years, and there are no classes within the Senate. So 2024, the Senate was up. 2028, the Senate will not be up, or 2026, the Senate will not be up. So there was a lot of debate in the Senate campaigns as well as the House campaigns, and candidates for governor. We have an open seat for governor. Our current governor cannot succeed himself. So we're in a hot primary campaign as this is being recorded. And the rumblings were already heard amongst candidates for the Republican nomination for governor about individual income taxes. Now, I'm so glad that you asked that question about why only the individual income tax, because our state Senate had other ideas as well. Our state Senate was concerned about industrial property taxes, and our state House was concerned about the property tax for small businesses. So during the 2025-26 session, we had a lot of cures, in some cases cures in search of a disease, but we had lots of cures in play to fix the business property tax, to conform to the federal tax code through the One Big Beautiful Bill. and grant a reduction in tax on overtime and bonuses. So a lot of tax discussion, more than we've probably had in 20 years, that all took place in 25 and 26. But at the end of the day, the real key, the linchpin, the major reform was in the individual income tax.
What did the lawmakers do there with their big old seven?
Well, you know, we've been chipping away at our problem for a number of years, beginning probably 2022. We started backing that 7% down to, in one hit, 6.5, and then it was trickling down 6.42, and then it was accelerated at some point. But really, what was needed is for us to get away from taxable income as a basis and go like pretty much everybody else to adjusted gross income. The problem with that was going to have an effect on what the end rate could be. But we'd already collapsed our tax brackets from 5 to 3. We had already indexed our tax rates for inflation. So we made a lot of good changes, but what we really wanted is to completely flatten the tax code with a goal of getting eventually to zero. Now that kind of lets the cat out of the bag a little bit as the ultimate goal. But what the legislation actually did is it created a two-rate structure, the first rate being 5.21% and the second rate being 1.99. So we went from 5 brackets to 3 brackets to 2 brackets. But also built into this bill is to get everyone to 1.99. So as along with going to adjusted gross income, that was pretty significant. At first, it doesn't sound like that, going from 6 to 5.21. But there are a lot of other things that were going on being cleaned up in the background that made that possible. But the goal, the immediate goal, is to get everyone to 1.99. And the House of Representatives, because tax bills have to begin in the House, as I'm sure they do in Michigan, the Senate was waiting in the wings to try to sweeten it. And they did. It was originally going to 5.39 and 1.99%. The Senate said, we could do a little better. Let's go to 5.21 and 1.99. So that's the major reform, and we are pretty excited about that because we were sitting at that big old 7 for so long.
Mm-hmm. What is the difference between taxable income and adjusted gross income?
Well, as I understand it, and I don't know what it is about these complicated tax matters, but when we're in the moment, I have such a wonderful grasp of the weeds of these
exactly
things, but then the moment
about
ends, and then we start working on nuclear, trying to expand nuclear energy in the state, and all of a sudden there went my knowledge base. But in essence, we were giving the feds a lot more control in where the starting point was for calculating state taxes. So we had to do all these manipulations to get away from taxable income and try to get it more like AGI as a place for starting. And this is part of the problem originally with convincing the legislature that we had a problem, because a South Carolina 7% rate based on taxable income was roughly the same, and some other intricacies, was about the same as North Carolina and South Carolina at a much lower rate based on adjusted gross income. So in essence, we were being unfairly judged because of some intricacies of our system that were unusual that it took a while to explain. So we just finally decided, look, we're not going to explain all these nuances anymore. We're going to go to adjusted gross income, just like our neighbors. And we're going to go to a flatter rate at a low rate, and hopefully that will attract more taxpayers to South Carolina, which honestly, at this point, we're the number one move-in state, according to the Tax Foundation and the National Taxpayers Union. So it's not like we've got a lot of problem attracting folks, but we might as well juice it further and attract as many new residents and new taxpayers as we can, because if we broaden that base, then we can get to that 1.99 for everybody more quickly.
So it's broadening the base, lowering the rates, simplifying the rate structure, flattening it out. But going to reduce taxes from 7% to 2% or 1.99% seems like it means that the state is going to collect a lot less in tax revenue. And state governments operate with a balanced budget. And the biggest hesitation that any lawmakers faces to the idea of reducing tax rates is, where's that money going to come from? How were lawmakers there able to afford to cut taxes?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the answer so far has been the easier answer. The answer so far is, how do we reduce those rates? And just a little sidebar to that. A number of states, when they adjusted their individual income tax rates, they did something else as a revenue enhancement. For instance, if they were taxing goods but not services, they did some tinkering with the sales tax in order to make the income tax possible, income tax reduction possible. We didn't do that. We just cut the income tax. But for the most part, we were able to go from 7 and then 6.5 and down to 6 based almost solely on new revenues. Our economy is growing so much that we rely on additional state revenue to be able to pay for these things. But you know, that can't go on forever. We can't grow forever. I don't think we can grow ourselves completely to 1.99. So we've been looking more and more at Palmetto Promise Institute of the idea of state governments funding and spending. So what does the spending look like in terms of population growth, inflation, these types of things, with some additional understandings about the growth of the state and what that will do to infrastructure, what that's doing to education, which is all not always perfectly captured by inflation and population growth. So what the hard part is beginning, and that is, if we really want to get to 1.99 for everyone, then we're going to have to really look at state spending as well and try to get it down as much as possible in growth to inflation and the growth of the state. And that's where it's going to get kind of tricky, because when this income tax bill was being debated, one of the economists for the state famously said, you're going to have to find up to $1 billion to get this down to zero. I just want to know how many members of the House that are before the panel today are willing to house a prisoner in their homes. So at some point, the spending has to be controlled. And we haven't really had to do that since the last couple of recessions. But we've had capital reserve and rolling reserve funds to sustainability that we've been able to tap. So I see some challenges ahead, as that we just can't grow ourselves to 1.99.
Mm-hmm. As in this case. Well, although, isn't that kind of what you're recommending, which is, look, we can still increase the state budget year after year just by a smaller amount than the total revenues that we're collecting. And if we do that, if we practice restraint, then over time we should be able to afford to drop these rates to 1.99%.
Yeah, you stated it much better and more succinctly than I did, but that's exactly right. We if we can control the growth, we can get there.
But that requires political will to say, look, revenues are coming in at 7%, year more than they did last year. We're going to recommend that we increase the budget by only 3%. You know, and there's a big difference between the two, and you have to want to say, look, we can grow just at 3% rather than 7%. And that is a tough thing for lawmakers to do. There's every single person who relies upon the state government for their livelihood would prefer it if they spent the 7% rather than the 3%. How do you deal
with
that?
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, one thing we've got going, and you and I were speaking together right before we went on air here, that we're in the middle, and I realize I'm dating the podcast a bit, but I think this will be worth it. We're in the middle of a hot Republican primary for governor. Our current governor was the lieutenant governor under Governor Nikki Haley. And when President Trump was elected in 2016, she became the United Nations ambassador. So that left the governor's office open. The lieutenant governor, who, by the way, was the first statewide elected official to endorse President Trump or then candidate Trump, he became governor. So he was allowed to serve out her term, then to get elected to another term. So before he's finished, he will have been the longest serving governor. And we have not had a contested governor's election where it's an open seat since 2010. So 16 years of, I would say, kind of treading water, because the incumbent was always talking about what he or she did during their term. And that's been the case pretty much. But with an open seat, every candidate is going to be feeding off another candidate. So I have copies of direct mail. I have clips from the debate that was held just last night. I will get your income tax to zero. Last night being the 16th of June, 2026, which was the final debate between the two finishers that will be facing each other in the runoff. So whichever candidate wins, this is where I don't think we date ourselves too badly. Whichever candidate wins, they're both promising to get rid of the personal income tax. And then one of them saying they want to get rid of the property tax. So I'm not sure exactly how this is going to be managed, but.
And it was on the record.
Yeah, they're on the record. And I realize candidates make promises all the time, but these have been very aggressive promises that people are going to remember because of the ads and the direct mail and the debates. So they're going to have to get moving toward the 1.99 for everyone. And they're on record as demanding it. So if that person is elected in November, I think they will have, dare I say the word, a mandate to get these kind of things done, as we've really never had. Haven't had for about 16 years.
That's an interesting scenario, too, because I think your solution of saying, look, just practice restraint and we can get down to 1.99%. And maybe in a couple of years, I assume complete and total elimination, because revenues from other taxes would be growing and be able to more than replace the income taxes lost. But it's like that seems to me a much more politically feasible solution to finding a ways to save enough money to afford to reduce both property taxes and income taxes, especially since I assume property taxes in South Carolina are mostly collected by local governments, and forcing them to save money is a tougher position than saying, look, we can afford to reduce our the state's tax rates because we've saved this amount of money.
Yes, and that tends to generate a lot of complicated schemes, maybe in the British sense of a scheme, but complicated schemes.
Sorry,
to pay
is
back.
The British sense different?
Well, the British sense is more of a plan.
Okay.
When they speak of a scheme, they say it's a plan. Mm. We say, oh, keeps, it's a scheme.
Yeah, it lacks the nefarious nature that we use.
Right.
Okay,
right. What was it was a candidate for president said the other candidate was promising a risky scheme. So the scheme would be to try to find a way to reimburse the localities, or what we call the subdivisions, cities and counties and school districts and special purpose districts, for the revenue that would be lost. And we're doing a lot of that already. In fact, on the manufacturing tax, the industrial tax, we're buying down the rate by sending funds to the counties to allow them to do that. So,
It is a way to say, look, we're, as a state lawmakers, we wanted to do something about this tax. And what we want to do is not just convince local officials who are in control of those rates to do something, but rather to do something to transfer the fiscal cost to the state in order to get them to reduce rates or do something. Because some of that, yes, it's not always about reducing rates.
Yes. Which just seems kind of ad hoc and not very well thought out. I know this is a problem.
The most direct way is to say, local governments, here's some ideas on how to save money and to reduce your tax rates. You guys do
Yes.
Or to have the local voters who are upset about local property taxes ask their local governments to do something rather than their state legislators.
Right. Which, you know, people will... But people probably come up to you and say, I'm so upset about my property taxes, I'm going to have to talk to my congressman about this. People just don't always think about it. And I don't blame them. That's not their full-time work like it is for us. But they don't know the role of the state versus the role of the locals. And in South Carolina, we purposely or inadvertently maybe confused it because the states are, as you say, they're kind of in the back pocket trying to make the counties whole for when the counties are forced to reduce certain taxes. In fact, the most significant tax bill, this present bill excluded, probably was what is known as Act 388. And Act 388 removed the school property tax and raised the sales tax to reimburse the counties and the school districts for the lost revenue. And it hasn't worked exactly right. It's created some weird anomalies in the system. So I think we're kind of back to, and nobody wants to hear this, but we're kind of back to the idea we need comprehensive tax reform. The Tax Foundation has written about this. The Lincoln Institute for Land and Policy, the Taxpayers Union, and everyone has come to the same conclusion, and that is we've got these weird problems that have developed over time as patches have been placed here and there. We need to think in terms of what is a comprehensive fix. And one of them would be that, would be not continuing to pay down and the state kind of in the back door with the counties. Let's be straight up about who's paying for what and make it much more transparent.
So you are not a legislator. You don't get a vote on this or whether your lawmakers do comprehensive review of all of the state's tax rates and whether the compromises that have made are working and need to be revisited. So what do you do in this fight?
Well, I guess it's just what we would call just good old think tank type work. And that is we attempt to reach.
I mean, most people haven't heard of think tanks or know what they do. So what do?
Yes, absolutely. Well, in the old days, you know, a think tank would put out a 53-page or 98-page white paper with lots of charts and graphs and explanations for what could be done, maybe even offer plan A, B, C, D. And we've done that. And in fact, when it comes to school finance, which is a separate finance issue, we put out a paper with A, B, C, D, and the legislature picked one in 2022. Major
nice,
reform.
Because they don't have to pick any of them. Most of the time,
right.
They can kick the can down the road forever.
Yeah. So we were very happy with that. But now we have to, do things like this wonderful podcast, infographics, short, say, 5-minute videos about our tax situation in the state, little brochures with what we think the next legislature ought to be doing, which we're working on now for 2027, 2028. So social media, even this morning, we're working on some posts to take advantage of what was said last night during the debate so that we can just keep these ideas in front of legislators and the general public, people that go to political meetings, so that we have a little bit more control of the narrative. Because I think this is what makes organizations like Mackinac and Palmetto Promise Institute still very relevant. And that is, you can't just Google the answers. You can't just use AI to provide answers to these complicated problems. And you have to have the relationships in order for the people that are making these decisions to hear you. So if they respect what you've been saying, if they know that you provide numbers they can be relied on, then you have a foot in the door to getting some reforms done. And then I've noticed that there are all these grassroots groups, which that's not really us necessarily. Some state policy network affiliates are very grassroots oriented. Thankfully, in South Carolina, we have other groups that are doing that. But if someone can, and I borrowed this from our friends at the Mississippi Public Policy Organization, if we can make the dogs bark back home through some kind of grassroots effort, that mixes in with our analysis and becomes a conversation within the sphere of politics, and particularly conservative politics, then we can finally get some momentum. And that's kind of what happened with this income tax bill. It just got some momentum, and we were just very fortunate to get what we got then.
Yeah, and that happens. I mean, that is really important because I think a lot of people, like, they're local voters, they're state voters, and they are federal voters as well. And there's so much attention that gets placed on what happens in Washington and not as much about what happens in state capitals. And so just a little bit more attention makes a bigger difference in the state government than it does in the federal government.
Absolutely. Can I borrow that line?
Please do. It's also state lawmakers hearing from some of their normal voters matters in a way that it just doesn't in Washington. And so, yeah, a little bit more attention, a little bit more focus on the right things can make a big difference. So has your work made a difference?
Well, I think it has, particularly since hopefully it's been building up for a long period of time. We don't have term limits for our General Assembly. So some of the folks that were occupying key seats on this matter, Ways and Means Committee, senior members in the chair, the speaker, the majority leader in the Senate finance leadership, staff. A lot of these folks have been around for a while. I would like to think that they've been aware of the research that we've done in the past. I think one sign that maybe we were in line for some major reform was we did a webinar, you know, very much like what we're doing now. And we presented a lot of data, you know, charts and graphs to explain the situation on this this webinar. And I noticed that when people were signing up, oh, it's the chief of staff of the Ways and Means Committee. It's a key member of the Senate Finance Committee, a senator, and all these people are logging in. Now, what was funny is most of them didn't ask questions. Other folks asked questions, but they were on the line and they were listening to the presentation and the response. So that gave me the idea, they would not waste their time on this in the off session when they don't have to be working on this every day, unless there might be some possibility we would get something. So that was a little hint that maybe good things might be getting ready to happen.
Why do you think it was politically feasible for them to do these reforms as opposed to like a lot of the other things that you have been talking about and that you recommended?
A couple of things, just to be a little cynical, the state was flush at the time. We're still relatively flush.
That's great. That makes it more likely and more affordable to do important reforms to let people keep more of their own revenue when other taxes are generating a lot more.
Yes, yes.
I wish we were in that case in the state of Michigan right now. It would make a lot of things a lot easier.
Yeah, and you know, it's crazy how much of it seems to depend on weather. I think folks are leaving your state and coming to ours, a lot of them. In fact, our chief executive officer, Wendy Damron, is from Detroit. And she came to South Carolina, down near Charleston, South Carolina, partially because of the weather, partially because of the conservative political environment. And she says, there's no way I would ever go back to Detroit. But
especially this time of year, it's great. But yes, you do have to deal with winters and sometimes long winters that are so cloudy, you forget what the sun looks like. That's the story.
Right.
Which, Aaron, isn't as bad as it sounds. I enjoy winter and I enjoy a lot of winter sports, but I understand that those preferences are not shared by everyone.
Right. So I think the fact we were flush with cash and we have a very aggressive freedom movement that has various different iterations, and that there was a lot of chatter in social media and at political party meetings, and all of that angst was starting to bubble up. So all of this sort of came together.
Well, that's a nice thing, because it goes from a situation where it's like something can happen to your lawmakers having this expectation that they really ought to do something and that they're going to do something. And that change, that subtle things that goes on in these other people's minds, they're sensing the political environment, are very subtle, but they matter a lot to what actually gets done, because it could have just been as easy, I assume, and you've got the experience with this one, that they could have just done nothing. Or in discussing like these reforms, you had five people that wanted to do one thing and they tanked it for everyone else because they didn't want to go along with this agreement. That assumption is like, no, we are going to do something. We're going to do something about this income tax rather than the property tax or rather than this one, at least for now, is the thing that matters. It requires political judgment, political sense.
You know, one of the weird nuances to the debate that I forgot about until you spurred my memory there is, you notice I said that the rates that we went to were 5.39 and 1.99. Well, the previous rates were 6, 3, and 0. So for the first time, and in some cases, it is literally change that you might have cleared out of your couch. But for the first time, everyone is going to pay, generally, everyone is going to pay something. So part of what was going on here was that everybody has some skin in the game. Now, in some cases, it's very, very little, but that 1.99 rate does apply. So there was some division with those that felt that we were bringing people into the tax base that had never paid in before, and that was somehow wrong. But we took the position that most of those folks are going to pay nearly nothing, and it was good to have everyone realize the bite that government has, so that they are not just paying nothing, they're at least paying something, and they see the problem on their paycheck with what government can do to you if they decide they want to tax you.
So do you think you're going to get to your 1.99 goal? And then maybe even later, which is part of the policy, zero?
Right now, zero seems to be a very high hill. A lot of things would have to happen just right for that to happen anytime soon. The 1.99 I feel much better about, even though it doesn't sound like a lot of difference. I think we could get there. But again, the next governor to be sworn in January of 2027, the governor in South Carolina is not one of the more powerful governors, but the both of the candidates that are the Republican candidates, and the Democratic candidate, they're all very articulate, and I think they will use their pulpit very well and continue to remind the voters of what their promises were, which I don't think they're going to be fearful about doing that. So those are the things in play. Will the new governor continue to pound away at it? Will the revenues come in, and will we be able to keep government restrained enough to create that gap to lower those rates?
Oren, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.